know, the world of unrest in which we live today. So to us, it makes complete sense to discuss, you know, even more so why we need to tackle climate change, why we need a strong agreement in Paris, why we need strong climate action everywhere, solidarity, financial support from developed to developing countries, a vision with no fossil fuels in the picture, and a world where there are jobs being created thanks to renewable energy and energy efficiency. So all of these issues must connect in Paris and make sure that actually now we even have more of a leverage to get a strong climate agreement in Paris.
Alex Mazzouni, we want to thank you for being with us. You're standing in front of the Place de la République, where people are showing their solidarity with those who died on Friday. Alex Mazzouni is International Policies Coordinator at the Climate Action Network France. And that does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining.
KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Circus Church, Sunday, November 22nd, 9 p.m. at the Funhouse Lounge in Portland. There will be burlesque performers, circus artists, vocalists, audience games, confessions, and more. Again, that's Circus Church, Sunday, November 22nd, 9 p.m. at the Funhouse Lounge, 2432 Southeast 11th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The annual Transgender Day of Remembrance on November 20 was started in 1998 to honor the memory of those whose lives were lost in acts of anti-transgender violence. KBOO will air a two-hour special on Friday evening, November 20th. At 6 p.m., host Nia Nguyen will talk to activist Alyssa Pagan on Bread and Roses. At 7 p.m., we'll hear from artists and community members about the need to bring attention to the continued violence endured by the transgender community each year. That's Friday, November 20th, from 6 to 8 p.m., tune in to the Transgender Day of Remembrance special on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council hears testimony on their decision to allow people to apply for city jobs without requiring them to disclose their criminal history.
The Pacific Northwest braces for three massive gas refineries proposed by the Chinese government.
And the Hanford Nuclear Facility is declared a national park, while administrators for the facility request further delays on the cleanup of nuclear waste.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 17th, 2015. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Wednesday afternoon City Council meeting included discussion and testimony regarding an initiative to level the playing field for job applicants with criminal backgrounds. The push for legislation benefiting people formerly convicted of crimes follows a call from President Obama early this week. President Obama stated, if the disclosure of a criminal record happens later in a job application process, you're more likely to be hired. The proposed Ban the Box ordinance would require most employers to wait until after hiring to ask about a person's criminal history. Here's a short sample of audio from today's testimony at City Council.
The best way to break the cycle of imprisonment is a job. We hear that again and again from people that do this work, from people who've been in the criminal justice system. In fact, the City Club heard it last week when Arthur Davis so poignantly talked about how his future was determined by his father's gang involvement and his own choices. And then right there at the City Club, pointed out that he could use a job. We hear that story way too often. And so that's what this ordinance is about. It is both an economic issue, a public safety issue, and a racial justice issue. What we're proposing here is an intentional and persistent breaking down of barriers. It's very consistent with what we've done in other ways to do that.
I am Nikenge Harmon Johnson, and I'm pleased to be before you on behalf of the Urban League of Portland, of which I am the president and CEO. You will see around the room supporters of the Urban League of Portland and also members of my staff. I thank all of you for being here on this important day. There have been some recent studies, one in 2015 that I read and another from that occurred in 2014 by the Council of State Governments Justice Center. It's a nonprofit organization that helps to advise policymakers at a local and state municipal level. And that center found a few things. Both Black and Hispanic men were less likely to receive a positive response from employers, including a callback or email for an interview or job interview or job offer compared to white men. And this is after they did a study with similar resumes, just different names. Instead of Bob Jones, it was Roberto Jimenez. Instead of Roberto Jimenez, it was Kwame Johnson. But other than that, these resumes were on par. And they found that white men were more likely to get a call back. Men with criminal records were more likely than women with criminal records to receive a negative response from employers. White men with a criminal record had more positive responses than Black men with no criminal record. Let me say that again. White men with a criminal record had more positive responses from employers than Black men with no criminal record. 80% of Oregon's Black population lives in Portland. Black Oregonians are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white Oregonians. I won't presently discuss the reasons behind some of the systemic injustices that happen in our criminal justice system, but African Americans in the state are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white Oregonians. While Oregon's statewide unemployment rate continues to decline, the economic recovery for African Americans is far slower. The Urban League of Portland recently released the State of Black Oregon Report, with which some of you are familiar with. In that report, we talked about the fact that the unemployment rate for African Americans in Portland is 21%. When the overall unemployment rate in Oregon was 11%, we considered that to be a crisis. And yet, Black folks in Portland are dealing with far higher numbers, and we're not treating it with the response that it deserves. Portland is indeed the hub of Oregon's communities of color. And as such, you as elected officials representing Portlanders have the greatest responsibility to address those unemployment rates and to do what you can to change those numbers for Black Portlanders and for others. So why do we need this ordinance? Because we know the playing field is not level for people of color. We know what the data tells us, and I'd be happy to provide citations for your offices if you'd like to follow up on those facts and figures. Folks who look like me already start from behind. If you then add a conviction to their history, for whatever reason, at whatever time, for which they have served their time, done everything that we have asked them to do and come out with training, prepared to work, to take care of themselves and their families, they are still then saddled with this additional burden that makes it hard for them to do so.
That was audio from today's City Council meeting regarding banning the box to increase employment opportunities for people with a criminal history. According to a report from the Justice Department, 60 to 75% of ex-inmates cannot find work within their first year out of jail. In June, Governor Kate Brown signed a measure in which places restrictions on employers from denying applicants an initial interview based on criminal background. House Bill 3025 goes into effect the first of the year. The new law seeks to remedy, in part, the increasing number of unemployed young, poor, and minority community members looking for jobs these days. As of press time, testimony was still underway.
At this morning's City Council hearing, the Council heard from Adam Brunel on the issue of displacement of the poorest residents of the city. Here's Brunel's testimony to the Council.
My name is Adam Brunel, and I'm a planning student doing research in community engagement, as well as a climate organizer with 350 PDX. So I'm here today to talk about climate change and displacement. Last week, the city passed a resolution banning all new fossil fuel infrastructure, a landmark step on the road to a sustainable future. From Pembina to Shell No to the Climate Action Plan to the fossil fuel export policy, the people have been heard loud and clear, and I want to thank you all for your leadership on that issue. Meanwhile, we're in the midst of a housing emergency. Home prices and rents have been rising steadily and pushing eastward from Inner Portland at a surprising rate. Already, communities in East Portland and beyond are finding themselves increasingly susceptible to displacement pressures. Take Lentz, for example, where I have been helping a community organization, Livable Lentz, expand its outreach and understand past efforts taken by the city. In the last year, Lentz has seen the average rent for a two-bedroom unit increase more than 14%. Increasing economic development, fueled by PDC's urban renewal, has raised concerns over how Lentz will change in the future. The community is among the state's most vulnerable to the health effects of climate change while already facing the acute risk of flooding, the rising cost of flood insurance, and the so-called double vulnerability of climate change. To understand the planning processes in the neighborhood, I've read more than 1,000 pages of public records, spent countless hours working, interviewing, surveying, mapping, and engaging with hundreds of people in the Lentz community. During this process, I have found little to no evidence that the city's public process to guide development in Lentz was even remotely inclusive or representative of the neighborhood's diversity. Lentz is one of the city's most culturally diverse and affordable neighborhoods, with large populations of immigrants, many of whom are low-income and speak languages other than English. The neighborhood's affordability and diversity, however, are increasingly threatened by market forces and planning decisions which have so far failed to account for them. For Portland, a just transition requires that the city fights to end displacement and preserve affordability in its neighborhoods. Failing to do so is a clear violation of the equity principles set forth in the Climate Action Plan. And I apologize, getting a little bit emotional in this. I was at the Spirit of Portland Awards last night, and the anti-displacement PDX stories kind of moved me quite a bit. And with my last 45 seconds, I want to announce that 350 PDX, a climate organization which I mentioned I am an organizer with, in addition to supporting the city's approach to industrial lands in the comprehensive plan, we've become increasingly concerned with displacement and recognize it as a climate justice issue. The city has to prioritize healthy, affordable neighborhoods with stable housing that have a high degree of opportunity and empower existing residents. This means changing how we develop for density, sustainability, so that existing residents are not displaced. The displacement crisis, like the climate crisis, requires extraordinary and urgent action, and we believe that there are ample opportunities to ensure that the city's green climate action strategies fully incorporate anti-displacement measures every step of the way. 350 PDX endorses every single one of the 28 measures that anti-displacement PDX has won so far in the draft comprehensive plan. Thank you all. I hope to see the same bold leadership we saw last week, but on anti-displacement.
That was local resident Adam Brunel speaking about the displacement of residents in the city of Portland and the failure of the city to address the issue in the Lentz neighborhood in southeast Portland.
With El Nino and winter weather fast approaching, the Los Angeles City Council is finally taking some action to address the crisis of homelessness in the city. The city has appointed a homelessness czar, designated several public facilities as temporary emergency housing, and set aside $100 million for improving homeless shelters. Houseless activists in the city say that they've been disheartened by the slow progress in Los Angeles, where the city council promised 2 months ago to take immediate action to address what they called a housing state of emergency. But this week's actions are the first concrete steps taken by the city to carry out that promise. Politicians in the nation's second-largest city drew national attention when they declared a war on homelessness September 22nd, but until this Tuesday, when the city council voted 14-0 to have the city attorney draft an ordinance declaring a shelter emergency, little had happened, and questions remain about where the money would come from, as well as what a state of emergency would entail. Los Angeles City Council President Herb Wesson urged patience, saying the city has taken meaningful steps by creating a committee to find approaches to combat a complex problem. But the head of the nonprofit group Public Council says the September declarations of an emergency was an act of public relations by the LA City Council, and people living on the street are not seeing any of the promised support.
Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., city officials have begun clearing out several makeshift homeless camps that have been established over the last several months. According to a report in the Washington Post, the city plans to clear out a number of encampments that officials have determined violate city regulations. But the officials would not say when and where the sweeps will occur, leaving residents of the camps uncertain as to how long they have before their belongings will be confiscated and they will be swept aside. Although D.C. officials say they are trying to direct people to services, people living on the streets in the city point out that there are simply not enough shelter beds available to meet the need. The Interagency Council on Homelessness pointed out that the criminalization of homelessness is counterproductive and exacerbates the problem of homelessness. In the clearest sign yet that the federal government opposes laws that appear to target the homeless, the Department of Justice in August filed a statement of interest in a case in Boise, Idaho. It questioned an ordinance there that outlaws sleeping or camping in public places. The statement said that if a person literally has nowhere else to go, then enforcement of the anti-camping ordinance against that person criminalizes them for being homeless. In 1981, the district passed a regulation that prohibited tents, trailers, and temporary abodes in public places. And that law, officials said, is the legal basis for the planned removal of homeless encampments. But the residents say they have literally no place to go.
The state of Washington has a new national park, as parts of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation have been added to the existing Manhattan Project National Historical Park. Hanford is where the plutonium for the first and third nuclear bombs was enriched. Officials say that the sites will not glorify war or nuclear weapons, but will tell the story of these historical sites from a range of perspectives, including those who worked on the project in secret, as well as those of residents of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Naturally, there are mixed reactions to the dedication of these sites as national parks, with some going so far as to say that the park is celebrating war crimes. At the same time, Hanford administrators have requested a delay in the required cleanup of nuclear material on the site. KBOO's Galen Sanford spoke with Dan Sears of the Columbia Riverkeepers.
There's proposed changes coming in about the cleanup effort. Can you tell me about what those are?
Yeah, tonight in Portland, three different agencies will be holding a hearing about pushing back very important deadlines for cleaning up the highly contaminated Hanford nuclear site in eastern Washington. So what's happening is there's radioactive and chemical pollution that's been released into the environment. It's in the soil, it's in the groundwater, and it's moving towards the Columbia River. What these agencies are proposing to do is to push back very important deadlines for addressing that pollution, which allows the contamination to persist and worsen over time. So we're very concerned about what's being proposed in these changes, and we're encouraging members of the public to come out and to push these agencies to dig deeper and to act faster in cleaning up the Hanford site.
So will these delays have long-term effects on human health and the environment?
Absolutely. And what's concerning is that the agencies don't really disclose those impacts when they put these changes out for public comment. So there's an agreement between all of these agencies about the pace of cleanup activity. And what is before the public tonight is a proposal to move back very important deadlines for addressing those risks to human health and the environment. What we don't see in the proposal is a rigorous assessment of what it means to the Columbia River and to people who use the area to leave radioactive and chemical contamination in the soil for very, very long periods of time. So, for instance, in areas of at the center part of Hanford called the Central Plateau, there are unlined burial trenches with radioactive waste, and that waste is being allowed to just lay out there in the environment, and the pollution from those trenches could reach deeper in the soil, reach groundwater, and that groundwater eventually moves to the Columbia River. So there's a real-life impact to not holding these agencies' feet to the fire and not getting the Hanford cleanup done in a time frame that's responsible.
So on a different note, parts of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation have just been made a National Historical Park. What impact do you see that having on the cleanup effort?
It's a really good question. All of this focus is really on Hanford's history, and it takes, in many cases, a very narrow view of Hanford's history and doesn't consider the outcome of what happened with the nuclear weapons fuel that was produced at Hanford, which was a huge loss of life in Japan, a huge loss of civilian life in Japan when the Nagasaki bomb was dropped. And so there's not just a little bit of a blind spot in consideration of how that park was developed, but even a bigger one about looking ahead. So right where that Manhattan National Park would be, at the B reactor, below that reactor in the soils there, there's high levels of toxic pollution that the tri-party agencies, particularly EPA, has been working very hard to get cleaned up. And so we think that there's an opportunity to use Hanford's past and its history to focus the attention of the region and the nation on the very pressing, important problem of curbing the worst impacts of Hanford's nuclear and toxic legacy.
What can the public do to help the cleanup proceed without further delay?
So tonight's an important opportunity. The hearing will be held at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel, 1401 Southwest Beto Parkway in Portland. It starts at 7 p.m. We'll be there early in case people have questions. And one thing we're trying to do is to really push Department of Energy to explain how it's going to hold itself to a schedule, how the regulating agencies will hold it to a schedule that achieves protection of the Columbia River, achieves protection of the public, if these deadlines are constantly allowed to slip into the future. It just doesn't make sense to us to have decades-long delays in agreement that's supposed to be a firm requirement for Department of Energy to address the pollution problems at Hanford. Until we get these agencies to listen to the public and to fully invest in meeting these deadlines, continue to see unacceptable delays in Hanford cleanup.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Galen.
A Chinese proposal to construct three massive natural gas refineries in the Pacific Northwest has received very little press, but would have a huge impact on the region. The three plants are being proposed under the name Northwest Innovation Works and would cost $7 billion altogether. Together, they would increase demand for natural gas in the Pacific Northwest by 40%. The refineries would convert natural gas piped in from other states and Canada and convert it to methanol. This would triple the size of the fast-growing U.S. methanol industry. Pacific Northwest environmental groups have vowed to oppose the new facilities, which would be located in Tacoma, Washington, Kalama, Washington, and Clatskanie, Oregon. Two of the refineries would sit on opposite banks of the Columbia River, one in Clatskanie, about an hour's drive northwest of Portland, and the other at the port of Kalama in Washington State. Both would produce about 5,000 metric tons of methanol a day, which would put them on par with the world's largest methanol plants. But both would be dwarfed by a third proposed refinery at Tacoma, a busy industrial port a half hour south of Seattle. Double the size of the other two, it would be the largest methanol refinery ever built. These plants would also require lots of water. Northwest Innovation Works guesses its Tacoma plant would use roughly 10,000 gallons per minute and perhaps more. Sightline Institute estimated that the Tacoma plant could consume 1 million more gallons a day than all the residents of Tacoma served by the Tacoma Public Utility District.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 28th, 2015. No, not the 28th. 18th try, 2015. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. Tonight we'll be having an interview with Michael Wells, a member of KBOO's board of director. Then at 6 o'clock, it's Occupy Portland Radio. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be just like today. Partly cloudy after morning rain with a high of 49, moving to increasing cloudiness and 37 tomorrow night. Today in history, in 1865, American author Mark Twain's story, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, his first great success as a writer, was first published. Our quote of the day is from Dr. Seuss, who said, "Fantasy is a necessary ingredient in living. It's a way of looking at life through the wrong end of a telescope, and that enables you to laugh at life's realities."
Well, what do you know? It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The debilitating spread of inequality between the super-rich one-percenters and America's downwardly mobile majority is of huge economic, political, and cultural significance to our country. So why is it largely ignored by the television media? Meet David Zaslav, CEO of the Discovery Channel's cable TV empire. His salary last year was $3 million, but it was padded with an extra $6 million bonus, nearly $2 million in perks, and a neat $145 million in special stock gimmies. A total paycheck of $156 million. For one guy in 1 year. Zaslav is not just a one percenter, but a top 1,000th of the one percenters. Les Moonves at CBS is up there too, wallowing in the $54 million he was paid in 2014. In fact, of the 10 most lavishly paid corporate chieftains last year, 6 are television barons, with Comcast, Disney, Time Warner, and Verizon joining the elite class. Someone should cast the whole bunch of them in a reality TV show called The Wealth Gap or Us. What genius do they have that warrants such extravagant pay? None. It's simply that they are lucky hirelings of an exclusive club of wealth that owns and controls most television conglomerates. The billionaire media tycoon Sumner Redstone, for example, owns nearly 80% of the voting stock of both CBS and Viacom. So $50 million for Moonves is not a stretch for him, nor can other shareholders stop his excess. Likewise, only 3 billionaires control Discovery, and $156 million for Zaslav is nothing to them. This is Jim Hightower saying, when so few people with such massive wealth control the media is not likely to turn its public spotlight on the malefactions of great wealth.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Up to a 250,000 women in Texas have tried to end unwanted pregnancies on their own, according to a new study out from the University of Texas. The state's recent law closing many clinics that provide abortion was justified by state legislators on the ground that it would make women safer. But the women's rights advocates argued that the law at the time, saying that it would have the opposite effect. Now, according to the most recent research, the women's rights advocates have been proven correct. The women who need abortions will continue to get them by any means, even if it is risky. The Supreme Court has agreed to look at a case centering on the Texas law. Their ruling will have national impact. If abortion rights advocates lose this case, abortions will be severely restricted throughout the American South and Midwest, as more than 20 clinics across 7 states will be shut down immediately.
The level of revenue being generated through civil forfeiture has seen a dramatic rise over the last 15 years, according to a new report issued by the Institute for Justice. The study includes an assessment which grades civil forfeiture laws from state to state and found that only 15 of the nation's 50 states scored higher than a D+. One of the authors of the Policing for Profit report spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about the problems associated with such seizures, as well as what remedies might serve to alleviate the undue burden placed on people to get their property returned.
I'm talking with Jennifer McDonald. She is a research analyst with the Institute for Justice and co-author of the second edition of the Policing for Profit report. It's about civil asset forfeiture. Can you share with our listeners what civil asset forfeiture is?
Civil forfeiture is a legal process through which police and prosecutors can take your cash, your car, even your house, without ever charging you with a crime. And then usually they get to keep part of the proceeds from whatever they take from you.
How much has revenue that's generated annually as a result of civil forfeiture increased?
Civil forfeiture is a huge problem, and it's only getting bigger. On the national level, federal forfeiture has increased by over 4,000%. Since the DOJ began collecting forfeiture revenue in 1986. So in 2001, the DOJ and the Treasury together took in about $472 million. And by 2014, that number had increased tenfold to over $5.2 billion. Now at the state level, Oregon has also been on the uptick. Oregon in 2010, 11, and 13 took in over $5 million, which is an average of over $1.7 million annually.
And what becomes of that revenue?
Well, in Oregon, the police and prosecutors who are involved in the forfeiture get to keep as much as 62.5% of the forfeiture proceeds. And this provides a really perverse incentive for them to try and take your property because they get to keep a huge chunk of the money and spend that on their own departments.
Is there any disclosure about how the money is spent or how the money is generated?
Oregon is one of a few states that puts forfeiture reports online. And what they put online details how much money they brought in, as well as how much they earned from property that they forfeited, such as cars and things like that. So Oregon does provide some information online. However, they don't provide any information about how that money is spent. So we really have no idea where it's going once it leaves the innocent property owner's hands.
Can you talk about the difference in process between criminal and civil forfeiture?
When you're involved in criminal forfeiture, what happens is you're charged with a crime and you're convicted. And as a result, any property that was involved in that criminal activity is also forfeited in a court of law. And that's important because we all know that when we're convicted of a crime, we have to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And criminal forfeiture requires that same standard of proof when they take your property. Whereas with civil forfeiture, you don't have to be charged or convicted of a crime at all in most cases, and that's true at the federal level. Oregon is a little bit better because Oregon does require a conviction, but in civil forfeiture, even though they've convicted you of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, they don't have to use that same standard of proof to take your property. So all they have to do is show that it might be likely that your car was used in the drug crime that you've just committed, even if it was a gift from your mother. So the property is still very unsafe, even though Oregon requires a conviction for civil forfeiture.
What I found interesting about this particular juncture is that when it comes to the state or the federal government versus, often it's not a person's name, but the name of a piece of property as though an inanimate object is being charged with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
How does this pass the test of being in keeping with the Fourth Amendment?
The problem with civil forfeiture is that we don't have the same due process rights because it isn't us that's accused of a crime. Like you said, you will have cases such as United States of America versus $10,000 in U.S. currency. And the problem is that your property just doesn't have the same rights that you do as a citizen of the United States.
How can you determine that an inanimate object is guilty of anything?
So that's one of the problems that we have with it, is that there is no option to retain counsel to defend yourself and defend your property. The property is just declared to be guilty of this crime because law enforcement generally thinks it was likely either the proceeds of or the tool used to commit a crime.
The report's conclusion lists a handful of recommended reform measures that range from removing the financial incentives to higher standards of proof and reporting requirements. Is one of these recommendations more significant than the rest, or do you think all five are necessary?
Well, I think they're all necessary, and I think first and foremost, we would like civil forfeiture to be completely abolished because no one should lose their property without being first convicted of a crime. But absent completely abolishing civil forfeiture, the most important thing that states can do is remove the financial incentive for police to seize. Research shows that the system in which police are allowed to keep the proceeds really motivate them to go out and seek more forfeitures and to cut corners and take property from people when they haven't proven that they're actually guilty of anything. And so by removing that profit incentive, we really think that police will use forfeiture more sparingly and it will protect more property owners. I think something worth talking about, specifically the level of forfeiture in Oregon. The problem with Oregon is that we only were able to obtain 3 years of data on forfeiture proceeds. We asked for 5 years, for 2009 through 2014. 2014 wasn't yet available. And then in 2009 and 2012, the oversight committee that tracks these forfeitures told us that they didn't have funding in those years to obtain reports. So we really have no information for those years about forfeiture due to a lack of funding, despite the fact that they likely forfeited over $1 million in each of those years. So there's definitely a problem with accountability in Oregon as far as forfeiture goes, and I think the citizens of Oregon need to be very aware of that.
I've been talking with Jennifer McDonald. She is a research analyst with the Institute for Justice. For more information, you can visit their website at ij.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
On Tuesday, the White House announced it will delay sending a new plan to close Guantanamo Prison to Congress. Following continued congressional efforts at blocking the administration's plans, President Obama had previously announced a new framework would be put before Congress following their August break. In light of recent efforts to block closure of Guantanamo, the administration decided it would wait until the new year to put forward a closure plan. Language inserted into the most recent defense spending bill would block any transfers of detainees into the United States by disallowing any money to be spent on expanding or upgrading facilities within the United States to house detainees. In October, President Obama vetoed the prior National Defense Authorization Act, unhappy with provisions regarding Guantanamo and language preventing other base closures. Previous bills also prevented the Department of Defense from exploring alternative fuels and used accounting tricks to pay for further defense spending, surmounting the amounts authorized in the bills authorized previously by Congress. The current bill was voted against by only three senators, Senator Jeff Merkley, Ron Wyden, and Senator Bernie Sanders. The House numbers were 374, 58 against. With the Congress far exceeding the numbers necessary, the White House is choosing to avoid an embarrassing congressional veto override, and the president is expected to sign the bill.
Lawyers for a U.S. citizen who has been imprisoned in Iraq for over 10 years were joined this week by a former U.S. attorney general calling for the release of the imprisoned father. Ramsey Clark, former U.S. attorney general, condemned the illegal detention and torture of U.S. citizen Mr. Shaki Ahmed Omar in Iraq since 2004. He spoke about the case at the National Press Club in Washington, along with Omar's lawyer, Curtis Dobler.
The United States, because he is an American national, has said that they will try to have him released. They have made representations to me and to generally in the public that they are doing everything they can to protect an American national. You would expect that they would do that, at least after July 2014, because the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention decided at that time that this detention is arbitrary. This person was confronted with an unfair trial. The only thing he has ever been charged with is not a serious offense of any violence. He has been charged only with entering Iraq illegally. And the only reason he was convicted of that is because the American government withheld his passport, and he could not show the stamp that he has on his passport written by the Iraqi authorities that say that he entered Iraq legally. I have a photocopy of that. If I had been asked by the Iraqi court, I could have proved that he entered legally. He was sentenced to 15 years for that. Later, it was lessened to 7 years. He should have been released early, or could have been released early, I should have said, but in September of this year, but he was not. Instead, we believe through contacts we have in Iraq, and even through not a confirmed sighting, but the suspicions of even the American embassy in Iraq, that he has been transferred to Camp Cropper. That is the camp in which he was already tortured, and which we suspect he is being tortured again. So Shawaki has been in custody for 10 years. He has had repeatedly UN bodies say his custody is illegal. They have said in their opinion, or the opinion of the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, number 5, 2014, that he should be immediately released. Probably on the basis of that, the United States has realized that they should respect this person's human rights, as an American citizen, try their best to get him released. Until recently, we had hoped they were doing that. But in a recent meeting that I had with the Director General of the Iraqi Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Hassan Janabi, he claimed to me, and he's later put that in writing, that the United States government is cooperating with the Iraqi government to detain this person and, in his words, to get information from him, which is equivalent to admitting that they're cooperating in the torture of Mr. Shawaki Ahmed Omar. And that is a fairly serious matter. That is one reason why we've now tried to raise the attention of this case in the public domain and particularly in the United States. Because what it indicates is that the United States government not only is unwilling to take action to protect somebody who has never been charged with a serious offense, who is an American national for all they know, and entitled to the protection that any other American national is entitled to, but it also now appears that they may even be working with the Iraqi authorities to continue to detain this person arbitrarily and to torture this person. We hope this is not the case, but we have called on the United States government to provide us evidence that they are working to get him released. They have said that to me orally. They have even sent emails that are somewhat vague. But when we ask for any evidence after this meeting I had with the Iraqi authorities, when we ask them to provide any evidence, a letter, even the date of a meeting that they had, so that we could confront the Iraqi authorities and say to them, look, this is not true. The United States does not agree with his detention. They are trying to get him released. The United States government has refused to provide that evidence.
That was Curtis Dobler, the lawyer. That was Curtis Dobler, the lawyer for a U.S. citizen who has been imprisoned in Iraq for 11 years.
The online hacker community Anonymous has released a guide encouraging people to join their efforts at targeting the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, also known by its Arabic acronym Daesh. The guide is primarily focused on Twitter accounts. It's intended to bring those new to hacking into the fold by providing basic information on finding Twitter accounts associated with Daesh and exposing and disabling them. The guide provides instructions for searching out accounts and either bringing them to light through doxing or using dedicated denial of service or DDoS attacks against them. The DDoS attacks essentially overwhelm the accounts by continuously requesting information from them, which prevents them from broadcasting any other content. The guide comes on the heels of an announcement by Anonymous that they will be targeting domestic terror group the Ku Klux Klan. Following last Friday's attacks, Anonymous has shut down more than 5,000 Twitter accounts that they claim are connected to Daesh.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, November 18th, 2015. Troops injured scores of Palestinians during West Bank clashes. At least 41 others kidnapped during dawn invasions. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Palestinian youth were injured on Wednesday during clashes that took place in different parts of the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. Clashes between local youth and invading Israeli soldiers were reported in Ramallah, the northern West Bank districts of Jenin and Qalqilia, Bethlehem in the south, and Jerusalem. Medical sources have reported that dozens of Palestinians have been injured on Wednesday evening during clashes with Israeli soldiers invading Palestinian communities in the districts of Jenin and Qalqilia. The sources said that dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli soldiers invaded Silit al-Harthiya village south of Jenin after installing a roadblock in the main entrance. Medical sources said that soldiers fired a barrage of gas bombs at random, causing at least 77 Palestinians, including many children, to suffer the effects of tear gas inhalation. Five were hit with rubber-coated steel bullets. In Bethlehem, a youth was injured after he was hit in the head by a gas bomb fired by Israeli soldiers during clashes in Taqwa village near the city. 89 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire since October 1st, including 18 children. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, 10,000 Palestinians have been injured in the same time period. Also on Wednesday, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that the Israeli army kidnapped at least 41 Palestinians, including children, during pre-dawn invasions in various districts in the West Bank. Kidnappings were reported in Bethlehem and Hebron districts in addition to Ramallah, Nablus and Jenin. In Jerusalem, 16 Palestinians, mostly minors, were detained by Israeli police during the last 24 hours, 8 of whom were released hours later. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 18th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Yellowstone National Park officials are planning to kill 1,000 bison this winter, mostly calves and females. Park officials will meet this Thursday with representatives of Native American tribes, the state, and other federal agencies to decide on this specific plan. It marks the continuation of an agreement reached in 2000 between Montana and the federal government. They claim the killing of the buffalo is necessary to prevent the spread of the disease brucellosis from bison to domestic livestock. But there has never been a case of bison passing brucellosis to livestock. Instead, activists say the killing of buffalo is a giveaway to Montana hunters. Almost 5,000 bison roam the park this summer. A harsh winter could drive thousands into areas of southwestern Montana. Hunters are anticipated to kill more than 300 of the animals over this winter. Others would be captured or slaughtered by federal officials or used for research. Yellowstone has the only wild bison herd remaining in the world. Since the 1980s, more than 6,300 have been slaughtered and almost 1,900 have been killed by hunters. The Buffalo Field Campaign has vowed to remain in nonviolent witness to the slaughter of buffalo in Yellowstone all winter.
A group of children have effectively blocked a massive development project in Cancun, Mexico. 113 children filed a lawsuit 2 months ago challenging the construction of the $900 million project. The development would have paved over an ancient mangrove forest in order to build a shopping center and hotel. One 4-year-old plaintiff told the court, quote, "If we cut everything down, then we're going to die. Trees help us breathe." A judge ruled in favor of the children, but ordered them to pay over $1 million to the developers to offset their alleged losses from not building the development. Mangroves provide food and shelter for marine life, reptiles, and birds. The trees have been devastated over the decades by the tourism industry and the popular vacation spot. Not only are mangroves important for ecosystems, scientists say that mangrove forests can help slow climate change as they suck an uncommon amount of industrial carbon out of the atmosphere and bury it deep within their underground network of roots. Cancun is Mexico's number one tourism destination, drawing nearly 5 million visitors last year. Lawyers for the children say this is the first lawsuit filed in Mexico advocating for the collective rights of kids over corporate interests in order to protect the environment.